Hi, everybody. Welcome back to No Killing Goblins. I'm your host, Oshi, and I'm here with your other host,
Dragoness.
The dead Dragoness. We're both sick, guys. Don't mind us. We're just having the usual winter illnesses passing around and driving me insane. And we have a guest today. We'll introduce him in just a little bit. Dragoness, how are you?
Give me a moment. I'm going to...
Okay, I'm giving him a moment.
I'm doing actually pretty fine. Mostly it's just my voice bothering me. I'm going to sound pretty loud because my trick for talking when my voice is funny is just to get louder to get over it. It makes
it
worse in the end, but it has gotten me through many a Dragon Con. Or Gen Con.
You know what? It might actually make us sound better. People do complain we're all too soft. Like, if I get too loud, I get peaky, which is what I try to avoid. But, I don't know, weird. And I'm good, guys. I'm doing okay. I think, I thought I got the Rona, but it's just a flu. Stomach bad, blah, blah, blah. My voice is fine, though. I just have a stuffed nose all the fucking time. And a nice little fever to go along with it. It's been 3 days. It's great. Why are we describing our illnesses like old people, Dragoness?
Oshi, I have really bad news for you.
No! No, absolutely no. I'm not 40 yet. I haven't reached middle age. Stop it. Oh, although I did have a moment. I know we talk about being aged a lot, but I did have a moment where I was like, people don't know what Bewitched is. There are children alive today who will never know what Bewitched is because TV Land doesn't exist.
You know, that... I'm okay with that. I like Bewitched. I grew up watching a lot of, like, old syndicated rerun stuff like that, but I'm not going to say Bewitched is a absolute touchstone. I don't know.
Okay, you know what? Just in case people missed it, because it was very soft and probably will be deleted by the editors, just as he said, I'm okay with that, audible gasp from Oshi.
I know.
How dare you?
I'm terrible at being gay.
Ugh. Audible, like, Elizabeth Montgomery? The inestimable mother. Like, how could you? Anyway, we're moving on. It's not a gay thing. It's just a classic television thing, okay? Anyway, we got a guest. He's young. He's probably part of the generation that doesn't know what fucking Bewitched is. Here's Sean. Hi, Sean.
Hi, I'm Sean, yeah, longtime reader, occasional fan artist, and yeah, I don't know what Bewitched is.
He's not joking. He's not joking,
Dragoness. No, I googled it while you were talking.
I can't...
I mean, like, oh it sounded God. Vaguely familiar, like, but I was thinking, like, you know, Enchanted, or, Hocus Pocus. I watched a, like, 1970s Czech witch movie called The Girl on the Broomstick recently,
How white can you... Okay, look. I'm not going to say it because you know what I'm going to say. You cannot be talking like you just came out of a film festival with a Fellini. Like, no, we can't do that. Right?
I'm not that much younger than you.
22? What is it, 2012? I don't know. When
yeah,
were
was,
you born?
Oh, that makes you a decade younger than me.
No. That's because Oshi is off by about 5 years.
Well, okay, whatever.
So, you know, there is an interesting way that, like, access to the internet and how early you had it and how much time you otherwise would spend on, say, old syndicated reruns and fucking NBC at 5 in the morning because you couldn't sleep and didn't have cable leads to all sorts of weird... shit.
Oh, yeah, I was probably in the, like, the very last of the generations that experienced AOL, where I was old enough to have made an AOL account, but I was too young to really use it then.
Oh my god, you never experienced dial-up, but you did experience...
Oh,
wait,
no,
you
I,
never had
I,
the
I,
CDs
I
either,
no,
did
I
you?
No, I experienced dial-up and CDs. Just barely, though, you know, like, I grew up with VHS tapes and dial-up, but at a certain point, they disappeared, like, relatively early for me, you know? I wasn't an adult using those things.
And that qualifies you to be my friend. I have this. I feel bad for saying this sometimes because I do know a lot of, younger people through convention stuff and just gaming, but I'm not really considering myself friends with a person unless they are give or take old enough to have remembered what dial-up is. Any younger than that, and they're just too fucking young.
Ageist.
A little. Like, yeah, I know plenty of people who are like 21 and 22, and they're cool, but
You do end up babysitting them, though.
it can be hard not to hold people at some amount of remove.
It's not a remove, though. It's not a remove. I don't know how to describe it other than.
It kind of is. It's like these are the kind of people that I'll hang out with them in a group social setting, but I don't want to use the phrase they're morons because a lot of them are smart people. Some of them even have their head on better than I do, but they're not people that I'm going to go drink at the bar with if it's just like me, them, and one other person, with a couple rare exceptions, but.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it is remove, right? Like it's a perpetual like younger brother or sister or like niece nephew type syndrome, like you there's always like that barrier of age and like generational gap. It also like I think it starts to feel uncomfortable, especially if there are fewer people involved and you're hanging out with younger people in a more in a setting like that with fewer people.
A lot of them, I mean, yes, they may or may not have had to pay their own bills before, but I don't know, talk to me when you have a fucking mortgage.
Okay, now that's I can no longer relate to that point, but
Look, I maybe my experience is different. Maybe the people I hang out with, maybe it's because I hang out with poor people, but the because I've been poor for so long, I seem to do okay with the younger crowd. Oh my God, I'm gonna say this out loud. I seem to do okay with the younger crowd, but you do kind of fall into this weird kind of mentor-y, not mentor-y, but more like a source of information for them. And they're like, you know this stuff, like that kind of situation. And I do know that stuff. I have experienced that stuff. That pain has occurred to me, yes. And it normally it's okay, and sometimes I just don't want to do that. That's the only like age differential problem. Which, by the way, this is why I still think the Nears and Aaron thing will never work. Because if just being friends can be strange. Although, to be fair, I do like age gaps.
as long as everyone involved is a consenting adult and everyone matures at different rates, and some people just look for different things in a partner, I don't know if I'd say that, there's a hard ironclad rule here. I just know that if I find myself hanging out with somebody who's like 23-ish or under, they have no fucking clue what anything going on is at all.
About that. I don't like disrespecting anyone or their experience. It's just you shape yourself differently. And a lot of times someone who's younger can often have more, I don't know how to say this, but more realistic picture of the world sometimes than you do. Because they live in it in a different way. They walk in it a different way. I could never like I grew up with Instagram, but I've never been one of those people who literally uses it to communicate with people and like date. Like that happens a lot. And that's the millennial generation that's there. And that never happened to me. I was just never a native user. And the same thing occurs with like TikTok. And I'm using technological shorthand, but there's tons of things that are more social that are just so different for people who are younger. All right, Sean, you go to bars. I haven't gone to a bar in like 7 years. How the fuck do you guys like end up at the bar?
Well,
Like, how do you
Oshi,
pick a
I'm
bar?
pretty sure you are a millennial.
I am a millennial, but I'm saying I never caught on to Instagram. I had a different
I
platform
mean,
for that.
going to bars, you can just go to one.
Grindr. Just in case, wait, just in case it wasn't clear, it's Grindr. That's where.
Yeah, which has gotten so corporate and just fucking sucks now.
Go on, Sean.
I mean, so I go to bars from a sort of like a cocktail hobby standpoint. I used to bartend a little, and I like drinks and drinking, and so I tend to go to bars that I think are going to have drinks that I'll like, and so that's kind of the percent. Other people might be going based on like certain aesthetics or vibes of the general kind of establishment they're looking for. That's generally what people are doing. Maybe people want to go to like a karaoke bar or like a bar that's a bit more of a club, that sort of thing.
That's not really what I was thinking about. Like, when I was younger, there were three ways to find out about a new bar that opened, or an old bar that's good. You ask your friends, you ask somebody older, or you go bar, like, you just literally walk around and look at bars. At least this is New York, this is New York City, though this is different for other places. But that's it, word of mouth, that's how I do it. I don't think you need to do any of that shit anymore, right?
Not really. It still helps, especially if you want to find good bars. Yeah. But
I mean, Google exists and Google Maps, and generally now, if you, like, search engines are not the best these days, but you can type in, like, good bars in this area, and you'll get, like, a bunch of lists from various websites where people have been like, oh, the top 15 bars in your area. I often find that for food and, like, restaurant bar-related stuff, that type of article is a bit more helpful, because a lot of things you Google nowadays, and you just don't get good results in that vein, you know? But for, like, food industry, I feel like it's still okay.
I have to ask now, especially if you're a cocktail guy, what's your favorite cocktail?
Good question. I like a Manhattan or various types of martini. I like a Vesper martini. Also like French 75s. Those are pretty good. Hard to pick a single favorite.
I'm a huge old-fashioned guy. Old-fashioned and whiskey sours.
Yeah, old-fashioned's a great whiskey sours. I love whiskey as well, so I drink a lot of whiskey too.
Oh, man. I was just looking up, because the last time I, like, went to a bar, was in fucking Charlotte, because I drove out for a comedy show, and it looks like, all I did was just, like, Google hookah lounge near me, and went out to that, and sadly, it does appear to be closed now. I was just trying to look the name up. That's a shame.
Okay, we've gone off the beaten path. We should probably get back to things before Kyle ever kills us. And we end up making, like, a three-hour thing.
Hey, but this is the perfect transition back into the Wandering End, though, because we're talking about drinks.
That's true.
The fact that Aaron doesn't know how to fucking make any.
Oh, God. Do you want some alcohol? Every bartender or drinker or anybody who's ever lived in any culture where they're drinking cringed. Like, that wasn't just cringe. That was just, like, do you want some alcohol?
That's a level of immense shelteredness that is difficult to even.
The thing is, I think it's pirate. I've said this before. I think it's definitely Pirate ABBA. Like when we were doing the thing, it's not Aaron. It's definitely Pirate ABBA because they do it with a bunch of other people and go like alcohol, like what?
I don't want to speculate too much on Pirate, just because you know. Pirate's a notoriously private person, but yeah, there are certain things through the narrative that make it seem like perhaps a pirate is not a drinker.
We know Pirate's a drinker. We've seen drunk Pirate.
Okay, but maybe Pirate wasn't raised a drinker. I don't know.
Whatever. I'm just saying they don't know bar culture. They don't know bar culture. They don't know how to go into a restaurant and order a fucking drink. I'm just saying. I don't drink, and I still work as a server. Nobody ever said to me, I would like alcohol. I'm just going to go on.
I think that's what the three kids in a trench coat order.
Yeah. No, I think that I have probably in my life after... No, when I was doing restaurant work, and we would all go to the bar after we were done shutting everything else down and have a few drinks, I think I would probably be nonverbal enough to say, just give me alcohol. But... That's not the same thing.
That is not the same thing. No, but okay, anyway. Wandering in mugs. We got some TWI news, and Kylera has written it out. Wandering in mugs are out for pre-order. Plus, apparently they have new colors, which I'm jealous about because I didn't get a chance. So for those who are unaware, the merch store put out these giant mugs. I own one of them. And they're ridiculously good. They hold a beer and a half. And it's so good. Like, I love it. I've been using it constantly for the last 3 months. Those of us who were lucky enough to be it have access to the Pan chat, the highest tier of the TWI, like, well, not the highest tier that you can contribute, but just higher tiers of the Patreon were allowed early access, and then it sold out. I got one luckily, but yeah, sold out. And they're doing pre-orders now, and they can't do deliveries for Christmas, but apparently deliveries are in February. It's all handcrafted, and there's like this place in, I don't know, somewhere in the Northeast that makes them, and they like mold them, and what's the word when they do fire with the clay? Is it called firing?
Yes.
Firing? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they fire it themselves, whatever.
They're handmade, so it's all, they're beautiful.
Yeah, and it is like a display piece if you want to just display it, but I love using mine. I mean, and
they're so big that that's absolutely something I would have double as a beer stein.
Mm-hmm. The of course, if you're an I have a note here. If you're an international person, yes, it's expensive to ship it because it's all from the U.S. But I mean, it isn't exactly like you're gonna buy 13 of these. I hope not. I don't know. Is anybody gonna buy 13 of these?
Expensive shipping just means you should order more stuff so that you only have to pay shipping for all of it once.
Well, let's hope so. Okay, Inktober winners! So, if you participated in Inktober on the Discord, these winners have been announced. There was over 600 pieces of fan art, music, fan fiction. Y'all are fucking insane, and the folks are very, very, very stupid to take on this project. I'm gonna say this out loud. I saw the crying and tears from the mods who were like, how did we not have... What? No! They all expected it to be like 13 things. That was hilarious. Also, the winners are all featured on the latest chapter, the Horn Chapter 9.68. They're at the bottom. There is one that is literally just... No, is it 9.69? Not 9.68. My apologies. There is like somebody who won the cooking contest who literally made a feast. It is crazy the amount of food they made. I wanted to be at their house. I think it was a full table set out for like...
I'm hungry just thinking about it. It looked
like
so
15. It was so good. I think it was more Chen. It was basic something quest. Like yeah, yeah. And it was like a buff breakfast with like... Oh my god, the food. There was like... it's one of those pies that where you like layer the fruit in a nice like fan thing. And there was bread and there was cheese. There was a lot. It was very, very good. Okay, yes, I'm talking about food, but it's my fucking podcast. There's a lot of really good stuff. There's good music. Lots of some of the best stuff. I love the Simon did a poem that I really liked. At Simon. At Simeon. It's like a double M. Whatever. Their work was really good. I really want to like... Why am I thanking the judges? The judges did a good job. That's all.
I just want to thank everybody who even, like, laid hands in the thing. The whole experience was so cool to see it all. Just fucking what people are out there doing that are so creative and talented. Meanwhile, you know, we're just here with the podcast.
I will say the Artsy Nata art of Kulf is, like, a virgin. A virgin! He be a virgin, Brit! Also, the cult is now number 2 on my list of bangable on, like, I'm just saying, number 2. Like, he knows. The Twisted Heart knows. Okay.
Oh, and we have some other news stuff here, but something not mentioned in this, but that I did want to, like, at least briefly mention, because it's all exploding, actually, as we speak. I'm constantly going back to fucking Twitter to check on it. The huge book review bombing drama.
Oh, what happened? I haven't gone to Twitter
There
in the last
are
week or
people.
two.
Yeah, there's a link about it to like the Knitter stuff, so you don't have to actually go in Twitter. But somebody that had like a new debut book coming out soon went and made a shit ton of fake accounts to downvote and go on Goodreads and shit all over their books, and then had all those same accounts just go and upvote her book. Yes, they were in fact that guileless about it. The whole thing turned into a big explosion, and a couple other people have been caught in like the crossfire for weird reasons that I'm not even qualified to touch on, but it has been incredibly entertaining reading. I will send you the links to a couple of these, actually. One of them I think you'll find quite interesting and can probably elucidate me on.
I will happily read up on it. I'm not gonna comment because I don't really like. I can understand the basic idea. You manipulate the algorithm by using the negative commentary to create controversy. Then you use the positive controversy. I mean, the algorithm only understands what's the word I'm looking for? Engagement. So I get it. They're manipulating it, but what the fuck? All right. Well, I'll look at it. Later, and
Yeah.
I'll talk to you about it, but this is just wow. I guess book news is there's a new release for Beneath the Dragoneye Moon, Book 11, Mandate of the Heaven. This one had a apparently there was Reddit drama regarding the cover. The artist was accused of using AI. They weren't. I'm gonna trust Kylera on this because I have again. Sick and busy, so I haven't been keeping up with the Reddit drama and stuff. It's a nice cover, apparently, Kylara says. Just interesting to see.
A good friend of mine's a huge Dragoneye Moons fan. He did talk about this a little bit. Yeah, there's a lot of people that if something looks like it might have the same. A lot of AI art has an almost sort of shiny production value to it. And there are a lot of people who are, if they see anything like that, and with that particular kinds of shading, jumping on it, assuming it must be AI. Or you have a situation like the one that happened with Secret Invasion, where they had a bunch of artists that they paid to make concept art that they ran through and like did AI art for the opening scene, and everybody's just, firing off at anyone they can even remotely lay eyes on because everybody's kind of going crazy over the AI art.
I mean,
I
it's
feel
also
sorry.
Reddit.
I'm not a huge Dragoneye Moon fan, but I do feel sorry she got caught up in that. That's.
Yeah. I will say that, like, it. I don't. It's Reddit, so it can give me a bit of a feeding frenzy. I just. I don't know where to talk about where the AI stuff goes. I also read a depressing note about how. Sales are down this season, this winter season for a lot of artists, and it could be the economy. I mean, it's not a great economy at the at present. I don't even know if there's any good news out of like the store sales and stuff, like not like general store sales, like economic news. But yeah, it was just sad reading about it because there was like commentary about it. Hey, maybe people are just going to AI for stuff, and they just.
I can see a lot of people, especially at like the lowest sort of couple of rungs, who are wanting just, a quick character piece for like D&D stuff. And like they're looking in AI art now. Honestly, that's mostly what I've wound up using it for, is for NPCs and stuff. Because even if I did want to commission art for it, it's not worth it to do it for like, all the different NPCs and stuff.
What do you think, Sean? You're an artist,
Yeah,
or
you are an
is you?
artist.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in a general sense, not a big fan of it being so prevalent and out there. Yeah, like personal, it's one of those things where like personal use cases, yeah, they make sense. I haven't really played with tools very much myself, but I would also use it for D&D sort of thing. What I've often done for D&D is like I Photoshop existing artwork to match characters that. The features that I'm looking for. I've gotten really good at photoshopping adding or removing elf ears to art of characters. If I need to, you know, change a race or hair color, other things like that. Yeah, generally, like, personal use case is okay. It's when people are trying to be commercial with it that it gets really unpleasant, I think.
Yeah. But, and
Have you? Go ahead.
I was about to say, I think we might be bumping into a potential question on similar to piracy and lost sales, which is how many people using AI were ever actually going to pay an artist, and how many people who were willing to pay artists are now turning to AI. But something tells me suspiciously wealthy furries will always be out there helping keep the independent artist going.
I would presume so. There's also a new release for He Who Fights with Monster, Book 10's out, and James S.A. Corey's new trilogy, Captive War, starting with The Mercy of Gods. Dragonus likes the.
This is the people that wrote The Expanse, which
Yeah,
I
that's the guy
am
who wrote. Yeah.
wild about The Expanse. Oh boy, do I love me the fucking Expanse. I am so looking forward to this. It's actually not out until like next year, though.
Quick check through of my books to read. I picked up, I paid the Patreon for Shauna McGuire and picked up a couple of Velveteen Presents short stories. I'm reading K.J. Parker, who is also Tom Holt. He wrote and released three books, a full trilogy, Saevia Skorix Deals with the Dead is the first one, so I got that. I got something called A Strange and Stubborn Endurance by Foz Meadows, the second book in the Chaos, the Midsolar Murders books, which is like a space opera murder mystery kind of thing called Chaos Terminal by Mira Lafferty. I read a bunch of Shannon Maguire. I've been sick, so I've been doing a lot of reading. I read the new Murderbot book, the seventh one, which is actually more of a companion to the last one. By Martha Wells, System Collapse, and yeah, I think that's it for me. I read like five or six books or
That's a
something.
lot. I mostly have just been rereading the Kitty Norville stuff this week because I've been bored at work and I just happen to already own them all.
Do you has she done any new books like
She
in
had a different series she did that was like a Skold and Silver Age Heroes thing
Yeah, that's what I was
from the
hoping she'd
pers
do another book.
There's like two books in that, I think, but yeah, I don't know how much she's really done outside of that. But
She's
she.
done like the Bannerless. There was a Dragon Books. There was Discord's Apple, which was a really good
Oh,
retail.
yes,
Like,
Discord's
yeah,
Apple's
that.
the other one I'm thinking of. I don't know, I've really liked her stuff. Like, the Kitty Norville books are definitely kind of paint by the numbersy urban fantasy, but it's my kind of paint by the numbersy urban fantasy.
What was I gonna say? For those who don't know, Kitty Norville is written by Carrie Vaughn.
It is the story of a werewolf named Kitty, the name came first, who, while struggling with her condition and also working as a late night radio host, sort of accidentally starts up a weekly show as being kind of the voice of the supernatural. It's cool, it's fun, it's a little schlocky, but in a good way. That's my pitch. Check it out.
I found what she did because I'd already read it because it's on my book file. She wrote Questland, which is, I'm not going to spoil it, but it's essentially the idea is there's this English professor or something who gets invited to go with a bunch of military people to a secret island that's built up like a lie, like a LARP. It's like a giant LARP island. And it was out in 2021. I read it like 4 or 5 months ago. Okay, we're talking a lot of
Yeah,
books,
that's so
Sean. Do you
CK.
have
What have
any?
you had a chance to read lately?
Yeah.
Well, it's not incredibly recent, but I'm a big Locked Tomb fan. Read that series this year. I'm supposed to be reading A Little Life in the next month or so for a book club, which I will get on that eventually. I'm reading, at Oshi's suggestion, Every Heart a Doorway at a steady pace of maybe a chapter every 6 months or so. So at some point, I will eventually read that book. Yeah, that's about it.
I eventually read that book. But
I'm
do have
working on
you?
it. It's good so far. I just haven't really been sticking with reading it. It's become something that I read a little bit when I'm in an airport or on a plane, that sort of thing.
That's, everyone has a book like that, and just don't read through it, because you'll run out of airport material and then get really, really bored.
So I think there is definitely a part of me that just kind of wants to keep shooting the shit, just because I know what we're going to have to talk about coming up, and it's heavy, but we should crack into it. You know, for all of our talk about inns and alcohol, though, there's not really much of either or any good homey feelings coming up. There is, however, a rousing fun adventure. I love this horn stuff.
Okay, so here's how it's going to work. Actually, Kyler, I think we'll make this a long episode, if you're okay with it. We'll do an hour and a half. What we're going to do is, since there's three chapters that have been released, we're recording this at the second week of December or something, and this is Pirates Break Week. They've written 9.68 and 9.69, which is in two parts. 9.69 is about the horns, and 9.68 is the continuation of the cliffhanger after the Battle of the Solstice. So what we're going to do, just for the sake of those readers who are uncomfortable or who may not want to listen to our commentary on 9.68, because it does cover some fairly triggerable material, I'll say. It does cover essay and several particularly difficult topics. We're going to talk about that second. And I know, we'll talk. Don't worry about it. If you're interested, just stick with us. We'll make it the last, 30, 40 minutes of the thing. What we're going to do first is we're going to talk about the roaring adventure of the horns in 9.69 and why the hell they fucking do not have anyone who is a healer in their team. Just going to say that. I'm putting that out there right now. Why the hell were they not trained? Why did they not pay attention to Geneva?
I mean,
there's a handful of healers in this story. So there's like two and a half faith-based healers and a handful of Geneva clones wandering about. But they're really, it's not like they could pop down to the Adventurers Guild and hire someone in the healer archetype.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. We're still reeling from the after effects of, oops, all the healing potions are gone. I think that it's a little unreasonable to expect everyone to be...
I'm actually kind of not sure about the healing potion thing, because what's happening feels very much like Pirate is doing... you remember when the X-Men had the M event and all the mutants were depowered, except... there just kept being more and more mutants that showed up that were not depowered. Yeah, I feel like that situation with the healing potions.
I feel like that's not an accurate summation of the post-House of M mutant situation, nor an accurate summation of the story. And I'm torn between which of the two to be nerdy and nitpicky about.
No, don't be nitpicky. I'm just trying to create a quick parallel and annoy you at the same time.
Oh no, we have seen the effects of them running out, but we know there were a lot in circulation, so it has been a slow sort of pull down, right?
That's like, true.
We saw it come up big during the battle when there's this moment where the healing potions run out, and we know that the horns don't really have as many of them as they maybe would, should, or could have if they weren't
That's
starting
true.
To come come down in availability and go up in price.
Right. Sean, you were saying something about, healing. I know the rarity of the healing, but my thing is, now that healing potions are dearer, they haven't really adapted their tactics, because there are literal descriptions in this chapter where, Yvlon talks about how they could drop a healing potion on someone whose ribs had been opened up and who had a cut throat, and the person could stand back up and keep going. By the way, it still remains one of the most psychotic things that people go through, that level of physical trauma, stand back up and keep going, and somehow nobody talks about just how horrific that is.
I mean, most of them probably have PTSD and then thus don't talk about it, or retired and don't talk about it.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the most egregious example, at least as far as the horns, is, Yvlon fucking used her own arm as a weapon once, but that's in her, there's it's in her thoughts. We see little bits of it. There's definitely some trauma related to that sort of thing there. But I think the mental trauma is somewhat mediated by the efficacy of healing potions, right? Because they don't people tend to not be left with the permanent scars from these stains because healing potion makes them all fine and dandy.
And also, I think I'll just reiterate, because this is going to come up a little bit later when we talk about Kissimver. Adventurers are kind of fucking nuts. Ceria melted her own hand off with freezer burn and now runs around with a skeleton hand that she shoots magic out of. And most adventurers just kind of, aside from a bit of necromancy-related suspicion, shrug it off or comment how cool it is. A lot of these people, especially in this profession, which is a lot of our viewpoint that we've seen this world through and from, they're not
No,
balanced.
they're not normal. Let's leave it at that. They're not ordinary. They are extraordinary for, but in the weirdest possible way.
It takes something deeply not perhaps entirely in order in somebody to be an adventurer that does this kind of shit.
I do think, though, that when we're talking about adventurers of this level, the healing potion stain is not going to affect them quite as much because it's really becoming a classist thing, right? Because healing potions are becoming more expensive, but at a certain point, sort of past gold rank, adventurers start cycling through enormous sums of gold. And while increasing spending on consumables like healing potions is going to hurt them, it's not going to affect them nearly as much as the soldiers in the bronze ranks who are at much more risk because they straight up can't afford them.
Until
Yeah,
they have
that's
such a
true.
low level of supply that not even they could easily afford them. I think that yeah, it's pinching them the least now, but even then in this these chapters, it was a relevant effect.
I think so we're gonna get started with the actual like progression of the chapter notes. Start off with one thing we wanna like highlight is that this is like a way back machine. This chapter is a way back machine. So we go back 1 week before the solstice even begins, the moment when the horns have completed their, survival fight around the ice fortress against the things that Bulgrums has summoned, right? And the weird thing that, oh God, the reveal on Bulgrums. I know I'm skipping ahead, but let me just tell you, I spent the entire time in stream spoilers wishing and praying Pirate did not go there. Wishing and praying and just hoping that it was something else. It has to be something else. It's something with Marcia. They couldn't be. And then, of course, the reveal happened and they went there. And of course, this world is a sad sack, terrible, far
I
fucked up
think
piece of
now we
shit.
know why Terriark started to cry when he saw the halflings in Lord of the Ring. No, The Hobbit. He didn't
Like,
get to see the good one.
no. Oh my God. What did you think of the reveal as the halfling? That they're halflings, Sean?
I was just kind of like, oh, it's a big halfling. That's like an interesting idea because, halflings are small, but this one was big and tortured. I feel like I didn't quite get the feelings that you're talking about there, maybe partially because halflings haven't really been dropped in mentions quite as much as some of the other mythical long lost races. Like it's we've mostly been focused on elves and gnomes, and so the halfling in the recent chapters with the Eldavin business, and then this sort of felt like they were a new thing that didn't really.
To explain why this is a nightmare fuel for me, Bograms repeatedly says that he hates the Tyrandrians, that they made him into what he is. These battle halflings were created and sent against the Drakes, which means at one point, halflings were either enslaved, captured, and we know this, by the way, because one of the slave lords was Tyrandrian. So at some point, they enslaved the halfling race, turned a bunch of them into monsters, and then dropped them to go kill Drakes.
Yeah, there does seem to be an implication, especially when you connect this with Terriark's reaction, just being sad at the very idea of halflings, that they came to a pretty tragic, this might be the last of them, this might be what happened to them as a species, end.
You didn't make the connection, Sean? Was I the only one? Like, clearly Dragonus did, but.
I can see. I felt like there weren't enough puzzle pieces for that to be the obvious conclusion, I guess. Because like we at this point we wouldn't know necessarily know that that's the what beca the, what that's what the end of the species was. We don't necessarily know that the entire species was enslaved. So I'm at this point I can't really distinguish between like isolated mad scientist incident and like continent-wide warfare tragedy.
I mean, they named themselves Battle Halflings, so the assumption for me was, and there was a general, like, Tyrandrians rather than a specific individual who captured them, right?
What I think likely happened here is that, like most, peoples all across the in-world, halflings began to fade away. And this was just what happened to the last of them. Not so much that they were driven to extermination by this, but that what few of them were left probably were exploited and abused and just taken advantage of on their way out the door.
Yeah, I think y'all are probably interpreting it the right way. Although I do think it's funny that even though they're like, the sadness of this people, but also this guy sucks so much, we're still gonna kill him as best we
Oh
can.
yeah. That was perfect. That was
There
perfect.
is a difference between, yes, I understand this is a terrible thing that's happened to you, and you're actively trying to murder me right now and have been psychologically torturing me for like 2 weeks.
But in a lot of, well, not a lot, but like a certain type of media, which The Wandering Inn is sometimes, and you see it in kind of like shonen anime and things, where no matter how bad an enemy is, like the good guys will be like, "But you can be redeemed, and you can be friends with us after we defeated you."
Yeah, the power of friendship go fuck itself.
I'm not convinced that like the battle halflings can't like come to terms and be characters that we like and everybody can be friends. But I think that that moment right there was not the time for it, and it probably won't happen. But,
Yeah, I'm all for it.
yeah, I'll never say
it,
never.
I'm all right with the inversion of that.
The horns did leave him alive, so there's that. To break down the chapter, the first part one is them being hunted, right? And hounded by Bagrams until they're sort of herded into a maze, which is a remnant of the city of Shields. Immerleth? I think that's the one I always confuse what the names are.
No, I don't think Immerleth was the shitty.
That
What?
was the. That's Crossroads. Which one was Immerleth? Sorry, which one was City of Shields? I forget.
Lezigoth, I believe.
Lezegoth,
Lezigoth,
yes.
yeah. And
Right.
it
And.
is so fucking cool that they have, like, this learn to be an adventurer, learn to be a thief, learn to be this, that, or the other thing theme park.
Oh yeah, and that it wasn't even just a theme park that had the implication was that there were graduated levels of difficulty, and that they would do different levels of testing here. I love the fact that Bagrams sort of used these remnants and kind of transformed it into his own trap, but also the fact that these remnants exist in the Crossroads leads to the idea that maybe there are more pieces of the old Drake cities that were. Shifted into the crossroad, sorry, shifted into the crossroads as a way of protecting them or
Well,
something,
I
maybe?
think
I'm not
there
sure.
were just cities and places that existed within the crossroads. And I would be willing to bet that this maze may have been like a larger testing center where you came as an adventurer to get an official quantifiable, are you bronze, are you gold, are you silver type of testing. And I'm also just a little bit embarrassed personally because I had a very similar type of dungeon that I ran in my last big Pathfinder campaign, and this is just so much cooler. Like, where does Pirate get this shit from? I want it in a bottle.
What did you think of the maze, Sean?
Yeah, I got the impression that this was some kind of school adventurer, big adventurers guild sort of deal, with like you're saying, it's interesting that this is kind of like a giant escape room sort of thing with different levels. It's very cool to see how there were like the very different classes, and if you think about it, it's probably something that was designed to give people certain classes if they wanted them and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Oh my God, it is an escape room, isn't it? Why didn't I make that connection? It's an escape room.
I mean,
it's like a bunch of adventure.
Escape rooms are just like D&D dungeons parceled out into one room at a time.
Okay, so the chapter actually starts off with an interesting device, other than the fact that they're being hounded and freaking out over stuff and really suspicious. Kalth is, like, freaking out extra hard, but Yivlon is dreaming, and her dreamer class levels up at the end of the chapter because of it. And we see how the horns were able to, like, the Fae were contacted by Yivlon via her dreams. She managed to get past the Shadow Loaf somehow. Still don't know how. Nobody else could, but somehow she did.
Familiarity, and, like, she had the scent. The Shadow Loaf has a big weakness. It just turns out the dead gods are too rotted to figure it out.
That makes sense. So Yivlon goes a trip through Kitzenver's dreams, where Kitzenver is revealed to, like, maybe not be okay with being an adventurer anymore because he wants everybody to survive because he's a good boy. Pisces is still, like, trying to prevent himself from becoming the monstrous necromancer that everybody wants him to be or decides he should be, and even Azkaresh at some point has told him he will become. And she looks and sees that the fucking circlet in Syria's dreams is, like, teaching her things in a weird classroom and kicks her out. And then, of course, the big thing, the connection between that this chapter explores between Yivlon and Kalth. Yivlon enters Kalth's dreams, and we find out a lot about Kalth's past, or at least more than we knew before. We don't have details, but we know the general gist of it. Apparently, Kalth was a supporter for a long time. He was captured by the Naga and stuck in the Wishing Well. For those who need a reminder, the Wishing Well is essentially the laboratory of the Slavers of Rishal, in which they mentally and, like, strip
it's where different the red people.
Yeah, it's where the Red Class happened, but it's also where they, like, literally bottle the skills and abilities of particular people. They can take away your body, they can manipulate you at a level that's horrific. It's very body horror-y. And for Kalth, he was trapped in a sort of mental space where he couldn't believe what was real and what was not, and everything was, like, this maze that he was trapped in that he couldn't get out of.
Well, we saw this with Eert too, in the Naga chapter, where he comes across the Naga who's bound and gagged and butt-ass naked, and there's a convenient knife nearby, and he asks if anybody's ever actually tried to kill him, and the Naga straight up says, not when it was real. This is apparently a go-to thing for how he specifically likes to condition his slaves, and that's just fucking terrible. Off.
I have to
skin crawl. Like,
yeah, let's not talk too much about it. I think it'll trigger some folks in the first place, but it is a horrific experience for Kalth to go through, and then it makes him, as he comments in the chapter itself, particularly vulnerable to illusions and mind tricks. You see that in the way he deals with the maze. He's not able to figure it out. And for once, Yivlon does not go fucking crazy. She decides she has to deal with everything. After she contacts the Fae and she's waiting for someone to come, and she gets knocked out. She wakes up in the maze and she walks and finds Kalth. She decides to just wail on him until they finally, like each other.
It's weird to me you said that she didn't do anything crazy, because she solved Kalth's problem by doing something so crazy off the wall and stupid that nobody could have dreamed of it. It's exactly what Kalth said. I am the only real thing in a world of sand. The only truth that exists is something that no one can dream of. And then he got punched in the face. Like,
Honestly, though, that is the response to that stupidity. Like, not stupidity, but that kind of delusion.
I absolutely ship them now.
It's definitely like a berserker response to illusions as well. I mean, it just makes sense.
The entire time I was screaming, why is Yvlon not turning into a barbarian? What is going on? Why is she still a warrior? What is happening here? Why is she
not? Because she's not a barbarian. She is a warrior. She's a fighter with just anger management issues. She doesn't want
keep
to.
Telling yourself
she
that.
She doesn't want to embrace that kind of berserker identity and class. She just wants to be able to help control her, you know, deep PTSD after the end of Volume 1.
We just explored it. It isn't just, like, okay, we're going to pause here for just 1 second about the chapter. I don't want to talk about Yvlon or my opinion of it. I think people misunderstood where her anger comes from. Yvlon has always been an angry person. She has always had to be very controlled because she's raised in a household that, like, explicitly wants to control her, wants to shape her into a particular form, to carry on traditions and things like that. Then when she rebels and escapes the adventurers, she suffers. She finally finds some release for that anger, that thing that she's always had back. But even so, what shapes us as a child stays with us forever. So she's always been over-controlled and overly, like, protectionist. Remember, there was a moment where Yvlon tried to punch, like, she got shot on by Ryoka, and she was ready to punch and beat the shit out of Ryoka. Like, Yvlon's anger. Yeah, Ryoka had it coming.
I love the early angry chapters.
That was a natural response to Ryoka. And I know, I get where you're coming from, Oshi. I agree with you. I just also think that what's happened to her over the course of this story, the piling on of these traumas in her arms, has taken that and turned it into... That was what I'm looking for here.
It's no question. Like, we're on the same page. I'm just saying that it's oftentimes the one thing about the Horn storylines, this is a real, an advancement of the Horn storylines, is that often people assume that there has to be some kind of character development that is going on. Not every one of the Horns requires that kind of quote-unquote development. Sometimes it's more about the characters coming into, like, being self-actualizing and figuring out enough about themselves to be themselves. I don't see that as character development in the same way. Sorry.
We may have just a terminology hiccup here, then.
But... No. Here's what I'm trying to say. The folks attach character development to progression in classes or events or things like that. Sometimes the character development comes in the form that I'm talking about and that you're talking about. But it's not seen the same way. So sometimes it feels like some characters are not progressing and people complain about it. Like, Pisces has gone through so much, but, you know, Sirian's just, you know, gotten a circlet. What's that all about?
Okay, if we're going to talk about this, let's talk about this. This is as good a time as any to talk about Pisces and Saria and their development and their team-up.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm just going to go ahead and say that I have found Saria kind of just boring. And I've started to really dislike her as a person with the circlet on. She's kind of just been a fucking asshole. And I don't think it's a problem that she hasn't been getting that sort of self-actualization or character growth. I think it's something being stored up for later, because there's a lot going on here. And, like, having Pisces and Kolth and Yvlon have their big moments feels less crowded if everybody doesn't have their big moment at once. You gotta give this stuff time to breathe. But I'd like it if Saria could hurry the fuck up on her self-actualization and character growth, because I am starting to almost groan when I'm getting to some of her sections.
Kind of feel the opposite. I feel like the circlet stuff, I feel like the text has been trying to push it as, like, oh, she's, like, distant and calculating, but I feel like the way that it's been going, she's still very much invested on using the power of the circlet to take care of her friends and team, and she hasn't really, like, been making decisions that are so calculating as to be off-putting. Like, I feel like that's the vibe that's being attempted here, but we're not really hitting it because she hasn't really done anything that's that's so utilitarian that it hurts a specific member of the team and that sort of thing, I guess.
Oh, no.
Where I've been like, the circlet has far outweighed the negatives at this point for me. I'm like, yeah, I mean, seems fine to me.
I'm not saying that I think she's turned cold and utilitarian or anything like that. She was even pretty upfront about it in that scene with the alchemist, where she's like, yeah, just because I have freedom from morality doesn't mean that I'm completely disconnected from my emotions or who I was, and I can still tell you're a fucking heinous asshole piece of shit. I just think that she... Prankster Saria, like, comes from the freedom of morality. Specifically, and that's definitely not cold, calculating Saria. I just feel like, I can't find, I guess, the right words to convey what it is that I'm finding frustrating about her here, but...
I agree with Sean. I think she's fine, but for me, it's not because of the portrayal or anything, it's because I have a pretty solid mental picture of the internal mechanics of who Saria is, and she's always felt like the most consistently herself throughout the series.
Yeah.
The person that we met at volume one, we may have had different impressions of her, but that person still exists now, and that person is still invested in being the person that she was. She's a 70-year-old, like, half-elf. She's starved to death. She's lived a life before she became an adventurer, and she'll live a life through her... She's chosen being an adventurer as the way she will live her life until she dies. And for her, that means being captain of the Horns of Hammerid and keeping her people alive so that they will always have the choices that they can have. If they want to retire, they'll retire, whatever. And that's her purpose. She's chosen her purpose.
It's kind of not what I'm talking about, though.
Let me get to the end of my spiel on this one. So and yes, it's not addressing your particular thing, because I don't have a way to address your particular thing. So Sirius picked her purpose. She knows what she's doing. So Pirate has this weird, like, sticky way, like, in order to introduce, like, how do you get a character that already has her purpose in life set? How do you challenge that character? Well, you challenge the by making them question if what they are doing is enough. By making them, as the chapter shows, like, I'm not ready. There's not enough. I need more. And then reflecting through Pisces that is how Askbresh fell. That protective need got them to do worse and worse things until finally they went too far, and it was just like, it's a terrible path to take when what's the trite saying the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Yeah, so that is happening, and Pisces is seeing it, because, like,
that's not my read of
that was my read of this. Like, that's the only way I could interpret it, because I felt like if Saria is settled in her purpose, then the only way to truly challenge her is to challenge the methods that she uses. And then she says directly in this chapter, I will do anything.
Yeah, I felt like what Oshi's saying is what the text is going for at the moment, but we'll sort of see, I guess. I feel that it was...
No, no, go on. I'm just trying to say here, I get that, like, Saria, when it comes to the insanity of adventuring, is right up there next to Kolth as the two people who have it the worst, right? These are people who are going to be delving into dungeons and pushing their limits and trying to just get more and be more till the moment that it's too much for them and they die. But Saria, her arc coming into here recently, and... I almost had to stand up and cheer a few Horns chapters ago when Evelon basically picked her up and threw her out of a room into the snow, or, like, dumped a drink on top of her. Like, Prankster Saria, just the way she's been acting, and in this chapter, just I feel like I want to poke this groan worthy and like literally
I feel
almost.
like you just I feel like you just don't like prank like that kind of trickster
Oh
character
no,
or
normally I
the
do.
portrayal.
Like normally I think they're great. I just think Saria specifically has been getting on my nerves. And I'm not exactly certain what the best way to like put it is, and something in this chapter, she was just starting to annoy me.
I mean, I spent a good solid minute and a half laughing at naked Syria conning them out of clothes. Like, I'm
That
sorry,
was
though.
a bit funny, yeah, but I will admit that outside of that, a lot of, I think it might just be that a lot of the jokes aren't landing for me. That one
Okay.
specifically did. That one was great. But most of the rest of them, it's just she's kind of hanging around being deeply unsympathetic, and whatever it is and wherever she's going with this circlet thing, I'd like it to get there sooner rather than later. But
You were saying, Sean?
yeah, I'm afraid I may have to diagnose you with being the adult antagonist of an 80s teen movie.
Honestly,
Yeah, actually,
that kind of
that's
sounds
not far
right.
off.
That sounds right. Like you sound like the adult who's like usually I they're like you know how much I hate toilet humor. I'm that when it comes to toilet humor. But your the serious prankster stuff is just basically childish shit, and you're like, well, stop being childish. You're supposed to be the okay.
Okay, just to defend my rep as not being the adult antagonist of an 80s comedy movie, don't make me repeat my impassioned defense of toilet humor.
Oh God, he did do that. You did. I don't know if you ever listened to this. He spent time coming up with reason why toilet.
Coming up with free.
Like,
No. Anyways,
no,
so
we're not.
calls
I'm
my. No,
teasing. I can agree. I don't. Let's not get into it. But I know. I can see where you're coming from implicitly.
Okay, look, the before we drag on to other stuff, so Yivlon and Kulth do crazy shit and beat each other up on the way of like walking through all of the traps to escape, and now Kulth is calling everybody boss.
Yeah, he says that's how he lets people know that he likes them. And I think it says a lot about, who he is and as a person. He's the supporter. When he's calling somebody boss, it's a. I don't know if you've ever done, contracting work or anything like that, but there's two ways you can say boss man to, like.
No, I know.
Yeah. No, I think
You...
it's fitting his character, yeah. A term of
it's
endearment for him.
it is for him. In any case, so we have the other. We have two, three sets. We'll get to the third set in a little bit, but then we were talking about Syria and Pisces, who are like walking around trying to get through the maze. Syria is struggling with her circlet, who she figures out is the one who's afraid and is trying to prevent her from like doing scary things. What meanwhile Pisces goes through some weird shit where he like finds all these old stuff that's decayed and dying, and he's like affected. Honestly, I was a little affected too. I didn't really like, yeah, it's grandeur. I really wanted to see more of Lesica. You were saying, Sean?
Yeah, so I have something that I think ties into what you were talking about a little bit before with character growth on like a technical levels level as well as character growth on sort of a character emotional level. And I felt like this chapter was it when it started, I felt like it was laying it on thicker than I was expecting in terms of like the self guilt pieces was feeling about Pisces. Sorry, I always do that. The self guilt he was feeling about necromancy and Azkarash and all that. Where I sort of thought that we'd gotten a little bit past this more, but like obviously, like the way depression works, and these things can come back and sort of bite you and continue to, even though like you experience things which are to the contrary. Like he got all those cheers and applause, people saying that like he's their favorite and stuff. That doesn't necessarily offset the feelings of guilt, but I did feel like it was there was a lot of mention of it that sort of reappeared in this chapter. Directly to set up to for his new class, which I think makes sense, but it was like I didn't really see where it was going at first, and it was I felt like it was being laid on a little thick, and then we got to his new class, and it made sense. I'm not sure how I feel about this new class now, but I think we'll have to wait and see where it goes.
I think, so it made sense to me that Pisces was dwelling on this stuff more, if only because, you know, he has done a lot to get other people to see him differently as a necromancer and see necromancers differently to a degree. But then all those people die, actually, now that I think about it. Like, he has that big scene right before the adult Kreller, and most of those people died. But I think that him finally accepting a fencer class and being confronted with the usefulness of necromancy, when he remet Anna and Colt started helping, and they started using, like, the undead to go into the dungeon. And I think that it shook his worldview a little, or maybe worldview's not right, but taking the fencer class, digging up old wounds, the fact that he wasn't leveling past 39 as a necromancer, it made sense to me that it's something he was dwelling on. It's just his recent stuff has been so caught up with his slavery trauma that it hasn't been at the forefront until now. And yeah,
I think there's been something of a bit of failure on the part of Pirate here. It wasn't properly built up. Like, I think Pirate was doing it in a, I could see it, like you're saying. There is a lot of, like, Volume 9, Pisces gets quite a bit of support. They're back from the, during the chapters where they divided the loot from the Village of the Dead. Assyria gives him support. There's lots of people who are giving him support that, yes, we see something in you. We think you're a good person. We think you can do good. We think you can do it. And then there are all these people in, like, Chandrar waiting for him to save them. And we think you could do good. You could save us. You could do great things. And now he has all this pressure on him. And he has to figure out, well, how do I do that? If I do it the way all these... Oh, how did the other necromancers do it? How do they be good? How can they be good? How can necromancers be good?
Also not helped is the fact that all of these people saying, we see something in you, we think you can do good, there's always an unspoken in spite of being a necromancer.
Exactly, yeah. And it's just, I think Pirate sort of got one part of it properly, but sort of left the other part of it unsaid. And that left this kind of dissonant moment for me in the chapter, where it's like, what? Where did this come from? Sean, I know you kept trying to say something. We're talking over you.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'll start by saying Pisces is one of my favorite characters in this series. I've played a D&D character based off of him. I love the necromancy stuff that has pirates written in it. The end of Volume 6, the speeches he's giving when Montressa confronts him on the blood fields, one of my favorite things in the series. It is so good. So this chapter, I think I would have liked to see a little bit more of, like, callbacks to the various positive moments we've had, because I don't think they've all been, like, in spite of, especially his interactions with the Earthers. There's one particular moment where an Earther, he's like, oh, I'm a necromancer, and an Earther who just doesn't have this world's context is just like, oh, that's freaking cool, and it made him feel good. So we've had a lot of little moments, so I think I would have liked to see callbacks to those as well, while he's grappling with this internal guilt. And I think part of the issue is that he was already a Deathbane necromancer, so he's already, like, set up as this anti-evil necromancer, but then he's reaching for something a little bit more here. And the new class, I think I'm gonna need to see a little bit more of it to see how I feel about it, because right now, I feel like the way the chapter treated it was sort of like that his old class was representative of all this old necromancer stuff, and now he's moving on to something new, but he kind of already was something new before, you know?
That wasn't really the feeling that I was getting from the new class. Like, the new class specifically is trying to cover a lot of work and a lot of character growth, and I feel like the arc here... because for Pisces is trying to join a lot of both finding a new way forward out from under the shadow of Azkarash and all these other famous necromancers, but also about the way that he uses his necromancy to heal people and to rebuild things and as something of renewal and growth. I think it actually ties a lot. And they even mention it offhandedly about how death magic isn't as good against plants. And we know from the earlier Valor Teresa chapter that death magic is an important part of getting plants and stuff to grow. It's a whole thing over in Noelictus. It's just, I'm just not wild about the name.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you there on the name, I think, being a part of why I'm a little bit. I'm not fully on the train yet.
Hang on, guys. What would have been a name that? Okay, first up, let's not get too lost in this. I was gonna go like, let's talk about what the name should be. That's probably not what we're gonna be doing here. But I do understand what Pirate is trying to do, is that this is somebody who's trying to, like, Pisces is somebody who's trying to restore some glory to the necromancer name or whatever, and he's gonna do it in by using death magic in ways that haven't been done for a very long time. Because every death necromancer so far has been obsessed with creating like monsters and things to defend themselves or make give themselves immortality. We saw those necromancers during the solstice fight with the Gnoll that was basically a Koshak. What is the thing with the Russian tale and Slavic tale of the guy who takes out his heart?
Yeah,
What was it?
I do
Yeah.
not know it off the top of my head, but I know your
I don't
reference.
know how to pronounce it. I don't want to like get it wrong. Hold on. Let me Google.
I think I've figured out what is like keeping me at arm's length from it, and I think what it is that it's the whole class being about this sort of thing now, and it's sort of a little bit sudden. I think what would have made more sense to me would maybe be like a skill based on this, like a skill about reclaimed grandeur instead of the entire class being that.
Oh, maybe. I feel like, personally, I almost would rather have something that aimed a bit more towards the idea of his more unique uses of the magic, right? Repairing his rapier, repairing Evelon's arms. There's a clear thread across all of this. What the people tried to get him to do in his chapter in Chandrar with the body modification stuff. Creating an intelligent leveling undead. I see all of this in his new class. It's just, I don't know. I don't think that the perfect thing exists. You can ask us what we think we might come up with, but you know we already talked with about this, at least me and you, a lot, Oshi. I just don't think that there is a perfect name.
Yeah, there's no
Yeah,
perfect name.
his
It's good
character work
enough.
is too deep and too complex and too good. This is.
For now, the big thing that I wish he had done that I know the chapter addresses is that he isn't aware of the one group that could offer him a truly like positive view of what necromancers can achieve. He doesn't know about Kelta.
I mean, he knows about. He even mentions that he wished he had maybe talked with Aaron a bit more.
Yeah, but he doesn't know the way, like, what's the way Bone. I have to stop calling him Bone Daddy. The way Fetterhup knows Kelta, the way that Aaron knows Kelta, he doesn't understand what she really accomplished because it isn't part of the information that's like provided to people in Tarandria or Israel because they don't want to talk about necromancers.
It's also just one, right? You have one
It's not,
specific.
no,
Well, no,
no, no,
no,
no,
Oshi,
no.
wait. You have this one country, this one specific example that you can point towards and say, yes, this has a country held together by undead, and undead serve people. And even going back to, like, way back when he talks about trying to do farming and use undead for labor in a similar idea, he's not unaware of Celt as a concept. But even then, Celt is powerful undead, bound, not
No.
a powerful individual necromancer anymore. She's dead. She's been dead for a long fucking time.
I think Noelictus kind of doesn't get the credit that it deserves, just quietly feeding like half of
Well,
Tyrandria.
Noelictus is actually kind of a harshly negative example because the undead there are a terrible fucking problem.
Okay, look, guys, the reason I kept going no is because you're mistaking what I mean. Celt is the one resource, the one place where people actually kept records of necromancers, good and bad. It isn't just Celta that you're talking about. You're talking about Kelt being the repository of enough information to be able to tell him about good examples of necromancers throughout history. All the stuff that people have probably wiped out, including things like the rear necromancers, who is generally a good person trying to fight to save them. Like, these are things that are not kept by, like, Tirandria and Israel and by Balaros, even, because they don't want to remember it. Not after the trauma they experience or whatever, so they struck records of them. Or they just choose not to remember them.
We got to meet all those great masters of death in that Solstice chapter, and it was not batting particularly high on averages for people who looked like I want to invite them to a dinner party.
Yeah.
I really don't want to wind up rushing past the character mechanics between Kissimver and Vofia, because it's paying off all this great stuff going all the way back specifically to the scene in the Kissimver of Chandrar chapters, where he's sitting around the campfire and every single person there, including the Empress of Beasts, is like, oh, this sweet child, he has no value for himself, he's so young and inexperienced, this is horrifying, but he's adorable, we have to protect him. And then Kissimver is sitting here with somebody with this exact same disdain for her own life over just helping other people. You know, she'll throw herself on the fire for these people, despite the fact they'd really prefer she didn't. I love it. It's beautiful.
To wrap up the Pisces and Syria stuff, I really appreciated the way the City of Shields was work. I like the duel. I do understand, like, the changes that are happening, and yeah, sure, the reviving the golden, I can't believe Pirate went with the golden trail, and I can literally picture in my head how Pirate thinks that all of Israel is basically Disneyland, and the City of Crossroads is like a giant theme park, and people just like, whenever they visit, their picture goes up on the sky.
It's so funny.
So fucking weird.
I loved it.
That was insane. I thought Pisces was an idiot for not forfeiting the duel, but then it was very cool when he won. He got some cool swag.
Yeah.
No, I loved the way that he creatively manipulated his surroundings. It was the exact same trick, actually, that the King of Duels used, but with a bone wall. And then he took it a step further by, like, actively changing his momentum by grabbing himself the leg. And it was all really creative, and it really showed off an in-character mastery.
Right. So, speaking forward from that, we do get to Kissimver and Vofia, and you guys seem to have a lot to say. I'll just very quickly say that it was funny. I do not like the fact that there are female satyrs. It's very not traditional, and I don't like it. That's it. That's all I got to say about that. Everything else, I think y'all will cover, because you seem to have much more to say about it than I. Sean, what do you want to say?
Sorry, are you?
We're moving on to Kissimver and Vofia.
And I'm holding back the urge to talk about Satresses.
Yeah, it was a fun dynamic. It seemed like pretty secondary tier plot going on. I was having a hard time kind of concentrating on it with the other things going on. But it sort of was the logical reason for her being on this mission. Is, you know, the whole perspective thing is precisely what's been established to be the counter to illusion magics like this. And so hopefully some of the horns can learn it themselves too, because, you know, Ryoka learned how to do it. That'll be a useful tool for them.
I can't believe you didn't talk about the little rat.
I want the soap rat. I want that to be like the new mascot.
It's an armadillo, right? Like, it's a.
I can't picture it in my head. I think it's like a little roly armadillo that, like, squeaks.
It's like an armadillo, but not quite.
At first, I thought it was a roly poly, and then it was a rat. So I had to repicture it as an armadillo instead of a bug.
Mm-hmm. I did want to, by the way, Satresses are a post-Roman European artist.
I'm aware, but that doesn't make... All of this is made up, Oshi.
Don't, but that I was talking about Greek mythology, and you went to somewhere else. You want to be pedantic? I can be pedantic.
The alternative is to send a nymph, and if they sent a nymph to go help the horns, nothing useful would get done.
Well, I mean, maybe they could...
Or send over a male character, but it's kind of nice to get another
maybe
girl
they could control watcher trees. But Why does having a goat half need to be gender restricted? You know, that makes that's yeah, that works.
Fine. Okay, moving
Everyone
on.
Everyone can have goat legs, Oshi.
Oh, okay. So the pair of them were very sweet. I did like the reflection of Kissenberg's attitude from Vofia. I love the fact that Vofia it has absolutely no magic whatsoever, except she can see everything. And she's basically being used as a giant detector.
Also,
especially in this. Go ahead.
No, I was gonna say, she also sprinted through the whole fucking blood fields and came out the other end with just some cuts on her feet. I think she unknowingly is downplaying what a badass she actually is because she's so used to hanging out with, you know, the big kids crew.
Yeah, exactly. The Fae are, like, so many levels above her that she's like, oh, I've lived for 40,000 years. I'm like a baby to them.
Well, we did.
Like, what the?
We drank, we partied in the woods, right? Like, we aren't all that
you
special.
You know, I accidentally went over a mountain a couple of times, but it's not a big deal. People do that all the time. Vofia, at least, as far as I can understand it, is a satyr from the in-world itself. And as we see in the end of the end of the chapter, she's offered levels that she rejects, but she can't. Which means she's been through her species has been through the trial of levels and has been accepted.
Yeah. We know from the unicorn guy, whose name I just forgot, that there were satyrs around. So, like, it seems like her family or that, you know, clan, species, whatever, some of them left and some of them stayed. And I'm a little bit sad she turned down levels, but.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine the Horns will have an easy time befriending Risveri and the Gain. Why am I blanking on the name of the country?
Island
Yeah,
Domus.
Island Domus. Yeah, as long as she's around.
Yeah. Also, I think that Vofia and Kissenver, this dynamic is going to lead to strife later on, because Kissenver, he is not the adventurer who wants to keep pushing his limits till the day he dies. He's a lost child whose found family is made up of those people, and I think that he's found both the best group of people he ever could have found, and also kind of the worst in some ways.
Yeah, and if he ever goes and talks to his dad about it, he's not going to get a good answer.
No. No, there are no good answers that come from Kissenberg.
He goes and talks to Clem Klitsch about, you know, oh, I don't feel good about the idea of dying, and he'd just be like, well, suck it up.
But
back in my day, we died 40
years.
The end of the chapter is just, I think, chef's kiss. Like, them getting through the portal, the whole Golden Road thing, and then appearing on the coast, contacting No More Not, and getting on a ship, and then Syria fully, like, revealing that they've completed the quest. I also love the fact that it's been, like, what is it, 69 chapters, and somehow, until that moment, I had not connected the fact that when they said limits, none, that means that the quest can be repeated. She created a repeatable fucking quest!
So, I do have something to say about this end bit.
It's because it also...
The quest that imposed, because you hopefully included in the notes, we can see that Aaron specified that, hey, lock the gate that you open, and we also, like, the Bograms also wanted to, you know, follow them through an open gate. They kind of just ran through it at the end, so hopefully somebody can lock it down soon.
I think that's part of the reason, like, so this is going to sound weird. I think Syria was a secret genius in this moment, because they were going to have to tell these people where the gate was so that somebody can get a guard on it, and instead she used that information to extort a shit ton of help.
That's a good point.
Yeah, so that's why I loved it. Yeah. Like, it's stuff that she was already going to do, but she picked a group, traded for what she needed for her people, and got them to do what she wanted to do anyway, which was protect the gate that they found.
Yeah.
And now there is, like, no chance of anybody else also using the gate, only the people that Nomarnot set, which is perfect.
Yeah. It was just a huge victory lap after, like, everything from about when they get to the gold yellow brick road was a huge victory lap. I loved every second of it. It's a nice, happy place to leave this chapter on before we get into what I'm really hoping is not going to turn into a large number of characters I like becoming corpses next chapter.
Well, there's two things of note that does happen for the end of this chapter. One is the declaration that Syria makes that they will not set foot on Israel until Aaron, basically until they've gotten Aaron and she's ready to come back. And that is, and the fact that time is distance in the food situation in the thing. I know this is a tiny thing, but I love that. I love the fact that there is a conservation of energy. You can't just have giant loss of distances. They just, like, you're just experiencing it all at a faster pace. What is it at the end of the chapter that happened? They all declare that the hordes all declare they're not going to come back until they got Eren and she's ready to come back. Rizvari sends Admiral Dakalos,
I'm so high.
Who came out of, I don't know why you like this fucking Admiral so much.
Great, he was a one chapter wonder in all the best ways. He had a
whatever
story, an excellent self-contained character arc for that chapter, and a really clear idea going forward. And I want more of him in here. I want to see how his skill interacts with fucking this thing everybody's predicting where inevitably Pisces is going to raise a ship.
Yeah, I think it's a bit difficult when you have like ensemble cast as big as you have in Wandering End. But yeah, I think he's a pretty strong as far as, you know, side characters with very rare appearances. There's not a lot of people in that class, I feel like. He pulls his weight.
So, headcount-wise, we also have Velitrisa agreeing to transport Ryoka, Ebram, and Siva to... They said the coast, which is weird.
Because from there, assume... they can get to a ship. It's...
Yeah, Steve's ship... Steve has his ship, so he'll be able to get them there. But that means we have Ryoka, Eren, basically... everybody we give a shit about right now is going to be at or near Wistrom. And my prayer and hope is that Wistrom gets blown up and all the mages are banished.
All of them.
Okay.
No. There's too much juicy, cool stuff hanging around Wistrom. I don't want Wistrom to get blown up. I am at a point where I'm kind of ready, though, for what's-his-face? Teriark's...
Eldavin?
Simulacrum that Eldavin. I feel like Eldavin's arc has kind of run its course with the loss of Caligula.
I'm gonna all say right,
so,
he's dead.
So on your
I don't think he's dead yet,
on your prediction.
But I think
so Wistrom blows up and then in the rubble we see Archmage Zalkir sitting there in his underwear.
Yeah, pretty much. No, my prediction is Wistrom blows up. And just as Wistrom blows up, Cognita comes back and is like, "You motherfuckers blew my house up!" And then kicks all the mages out and just starts rebuilding it and just doesn't let anybody
else come into the house. There's too much mystery about the upper reaches of Wistrom. There's no way Pirate just clears that out and we don't get, like, payoff.
I think, inevitably, we are getting to those upper levels relatively soonish, because the underlying theme lately, and lately being a general, like, kind of volume and a half, being that, you know, we're no longer in the waning age, power level is increasing again, and we're definitely gonna get back there with magic and the upper levels of Wistrom.
Yeah, turns out healing potions were the problem all along.
We'll find out. So, I'm sorry if we mentioned at the top of this that we would be covering 9.68. It seems our editor and our manager and the person who decides if we stick around or not has said that we don't have time for this. We're going to cut it off at an hour and a half, and we'll try a second episode, for which I hope Sean will also come.
Yeah, again. Possibly.
Possibly. And we'll cover 9.68 as a separate topic before we do anything. Or maybe we just never cover it. I'm fine with either way. Like, all that we need to talk about is the fact that the Grand Design likes Eren. And that Eren is A devil worshiper now. That's all that matters.
Close enough.
Everything else can just wait. Yeah, that's close enough. That covers everything. Okay. Thank you so much, Sean, for coming on and joining us in the discussion.
Problem. Thanks for having me.
I hope it was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins,
edited by Liquid Ender.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at No Killing Goblin, or email us at nokillinggoblins with an S at gmail.com.